Biography in sound.
Mr. Allen! Mr. Allen!
The National Broadcasting Company presents transcribed A Portrait of Fred Allen.
There's only one Chaplin, one Buster Keaton, one W.C. Fields, and there was only one Fred Allen.
He liked to say something, and that was the thing I admired most about him. His jokes poked fun at somebody that needed it.
Although caustic at times, never at anyone's expense. He was never cruel. He was always tender and thinking of his fellow man.
The way he talked, the way he think, the way he feel toward people, I have a great respect on him. So I thought he was such a wonderful human being. Good man, shows us good example in our society.
His wit and humor came right out of him just like water out of a faucet.
As he once said to me, I never want to get used to anything I may ever have to do without.
Now, if he's sitting on his own special cloud, he's probably giving everybody up there a wonderful time.
Allen Fred. Born in Boston, and at my birth, a strange thing happened. The doctor slapped me after I started crying. My first brush with a critic. My parents immediately started me in show business by taking an ad in Variety, announcing my arrival. Fred Allen has diaper, will travel. I traveled to the three corners of the earth. Since then, there have been many changes. I'm not referring to the diaper.
Ladies and gentlemen, our narrator, Jack Haley.
No part of the thumbnail autobiography you've just heard is true. Actually, John Florence Sullivan was born in Cambridge. His father was a bookbinder in the Boston Public Library, and there, too, Fred found work as a stack boy while still attending public school in Cambridge. The pay wasn't anything to brag about, 25 cents an hour. Most important is the fact that one day in the stacks, Fred found a book on juggling. Fred began to practice juggling with cigar boxes, rubber balls, and oranges, and while still a youngster, was appearing on amateur nights in the local vaudeville houses. Benny Drone, then a professional vaudevillian, recalls Fred as a youngster.
He was sort of a pimply-faced kid, very thin, always looked undernourished. I guess he was. He was fatherless and motherless. A couple of maiden aunts raised him.
While still in his teens, Fred appeared as an amateur juggler, wherever he could find a stage to work on and an audience to play to. Whenever he could, Fred returned to Boston University to study. But most of the time, he was on the road. He was not a good juggler, and once, when someone in the audience heckled him about it, he replied with a spontaneously funny remark that was far more entertaining than his juggling. As time passed, his juggling became merely an excuse for his coming on stage. What kept him there, and what kept the audience with him, was his dry, witty patter.
I had a room. It was so small, it had removable doorknobs. If you wanted to bend over in your room, you could take off the doorknob just in case. At Mrs. Brown's, when you took a bath, you had to keep singing. There was no lock on the bathroom door.
Billed as the world's worst juggler, Fred played in vaudeville houses all over the country. It was on a booking abroad that Fred met his devoted friend, Uncle Jim Hawkins.
We were in Australia together in 1915, and he was playing over there one circuit, and I was playing with my wife on another circuit. And that was when he was a kid, you know, struggling. But even in those days, he was so far ahead of us, who had 5, 6, 8, 10 years on him in the comedy department and everything else. He was way ahead of us. And nobody helped Fred Allen but Fred Allen. Don't ever let anybody tell you that they helped him, because that marvelous creative mind of his is what did everything.
While he was in Australia, Fred's path crossed with that of his old friend, Doc Rockwell.
The people there are very provincial, and they looked on these American actors. We wore different clothes, and they'd run down the streets hoo-hooing and laughing and booing in the theaters. And the ordeal until you finally got through and out of there was terrific. And Fred had quite a little device to annoy the people in the hotels, the hotel proprietors. He made out of rubber, little sheets of rubber. He cut small little things that looked like footprints and made little rubber stamps out of them. And in the hotel, going from the lavatory, the washbowl, to the bathtub, he would have these little series of footprints that would come out and go over as if they had disappeared down the drain.
The life of a vaudevillian was never an easy one, but for Fred, it was especially hard for a very special reason. Uncle Jim Hawkins.
Fred was canceled, not because he didn't do a good act, but because he wasn't understood. The manager would call up and say, "I hate to cancel this kid." I laughed like the dickens. The musicians laughed, the stagehands laughed, but our audience didn't know what he was doing, you see? And as I say, in those days, we'd say to... look, why don't you try this? You know, you hate to see a kid canceled so many times. You say, why don't you take some old gags and dish them off a plate, you know, and let the audience in on some of it so they can get a few. He says, no, there must be some intelligent people in this world, and I'm going to hew to that line until I find them. Now, these are days when it took a lot of courage to do that, because don't forget, they were hungry days. They were short dollar days.
Fred was born John Florence Sullivan. In vaudeville, he was known variously as Paul Huckle, Fred St. James, and Freddie James. How he became known as Fred Allen is told by Benny Drone.
He was up in a booking office. A fellow by the name of Edgar Allen used to book the Fox circuit around New York. And he was looking for work, and the guy says, "What do you do?" He says, "I juggle." He says, "Go right down to the 14th Street Theater, the Fox Theater down there, and get your stuff down there, and you'll be able to go on for the rest of the day, and it's a split week. You'll get the 3 days' pay." So after he left, the man at the theater called up and said, "What's this fella's name he's sending down? Because we'd like to put his name out with the rest of the vaudeville bill in front of the theater." And this fella, Edgar Allen, said, "His name is Edgar Allen." And the fella on the other side thought he said Fred Allen, so out went Fred Allen, and from then on he was known as Fred Allen.
Fred made his Broadway bow in the passing show of 1922. Later he appeared in Greenwich Village Follies, Three's a Crowd, and The Little Show. Appearing with him in The Little Show were Libby Holman and Clifton Webb.
The first time I ever met Fred was on the stage of the Music Box Theater. We were called there for a reading of the various sketches. And from the moment I met him, I realized that this was a very generous, sympathetic, wonderful man. We'd played the show for a year in New York. And Fred became a great, great success.
Perhaps one reason for Fred's success is that he was always dedicated to his work.
He was an actor of the old school, you know, a comedian with a fine intellect.
George Jessel.
His talents would have stood up in the days of Raymond Hitchcock, Nat Goodwin, Willie Collier, and Julius Tannen on the stage. And the lecture halls, he would have ably held his own with any Will Rogers, Peter Finley, Dunn, and all the other giants of a more literate age. As I think of him now, I think that Fred would have been more appreciated in the days of swirling capes and low bows.
Another longtime friend and admirer of Fred's is John Royal.
While many actors were playing the horses or the nightclubs, Fred would be in his dressing room playing the typewriter one finger, either writing for himself or writing for some other artist not so well off who needed some material. He never became competitive with people. Fred never kicked about billing. He never kicked about dressing rooms. All he wanted was a space in one where he could go out and work. Fred never was vicious.
Fred found happiness in his work on the stage, but he found an even greater happiness in a person he met there. Fred and Portland were married on May 4th, 1927. It was an extraordinarily happy marriage.
And this wonderful woman, she was a great inspiration to Fred, everything he did.
Uncle Jim Hawkins.
because he respected her so much. When he would write hour after hour and hour at any time in the morning, she was with him, always. All night when he'd be writing, and she would set the time for him to take the walks. When she'd say, that's enough, let's take a walk, he would drop everything. There was never any such thing as a squabble in that family, and there was no one ever as married as they were, because they were always together, everywhere, no matter where they went. He went nowhere without her, and the same with Portland. She never went anywhere without him. And if they walked down the street and holding hands, you know, it wasn't any silly holding hands. It was a beautiful bond between two people that the average person today with this crazy way of living doesn't understand.
In the spring of 1932, after a two-year run in the little show, Fred closed on Broadway. On October 23rd of that year, he appeared in his first radio show.
This is Roger White, Fred Allen's producer in the days of the Linnet Bath Club.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The makers of Linnet present another in their series of Linnet Bath Club Reviews, starring Fred Allen.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello there, Mr. Allen.
Who is it from, boy?
Joe Miller, the old joke man.
Yes?
He says he can't be here tonight.
That's too bad.
The telegram's collect. To save you the trouble, I read it on the way up.
To save me some more trouble, you can pay for it on the way back.
Okay.
And now, on with the show.
After 6 or 7 weeks to critics, everybody, who was this Fred Allen? That's what really started him. All the radio critics just want to know who Fred Allen was. From there on, he really started to rise.
He had nothing else in the world on his mind but show business.
Doc Rockwell.
He didn't clutter it up with a lot of photography or do-it-yourself stuff or anything like that. He just concentrated on this one thing. I recall he read, say, 13 or 14 newspapers every day. That was part of it.
That's
but
right.
He concentrated on that one thing, and as a result, his mind was absolutely clear.
His programs were called at various times the Salad Bowl Review, the Salopatica Review, the Hour of Smiles, which in 1934 became the popular Town Hall Tonight. Sylvester Weaver, now chairman of the board of NBC, was at that time agency producer of Town Hall Tonight. Mr. Weaver.
Fred was doing a very literate, high-class program, even though it was broadly conceived in many ways and had a tremendous audience, which a lot of critics, particularly intellectual critics, now forget. They forget that the Fred Allen Show, the Town Hall Tonight Show in those days, in the middle 30s, reached, according to our research at the time, about three radio homes out of four, followed the Fred Allen Show. This is as big an audience as anybody could get.
Town Hall Tonight!
Presenting that greatest giant of joy, that mightiest master of mirth, Fred Allen in person.
I think Tiny's a little free with his adjectives tonight, but I'll try to live up to as much of it as I can. Now, before starting the show, I'll read you the Town Hall Bulletin for tonight. On account of the laundry strike, Madam Dugan, the spiritualist, says that there will be no seance this week. Madam says the laundry hasn't sent back her clean sheets, and she's not going to hold a sloppy seance with her ghosts running around in dirty linen.
The newsreel commentary and the newsreel little vignettes that Fred did were probably the most incisive commentary on the American scene that anyone ever did do in the mass arts.
The camera starts, and we bring you the latest news of the week. The Town Hall News sees nothing, shows all. Atlantic City, New Jersey. New Jersey Mosquito Association protests reduction of mosquito extermination fund for 1935. Town Hall News sees summer business jeopardized by mosquitoes. Mrs. Belladonna, committee sister, aroused.
I was chairman of the committee last year, but when the mosquitoes got through with me, I couldn't use my chair all summer. The next mosquito stings me, I'm going to sting him right back in the same place, if possible.
Now to Herman Woke in London.
I was one of his assistant scriptwriters in Town Hall Tonight. course, Fred was by far the best writer of the lot on the show, and I think I can say, and nobody would argue this statement, that Fred was the best writer that radio ever had. He was an original humorist of the first quality, and the purpose of having youngsters like myself around was simply to eke out the sheer volume of the material.
Toward the end of each Town Hall Tonight show, Fred would feature some amateurs. It didn't matter much what their talent was. What made it so wonderful was Fred's ad-lib interviews with these people. It was one of these amateurs who was the cause of one of the classic feuds of show business.
Fred had a boy violinist on the show. He was 10 years old. And he played the B. And when he got through with the number, he said to him, he asked this boy, he said, how old are you? And the boy says, 10. He says, 10 years old, and you played the B so well. He says, Jack Benny ought to be ashamed of himself. And that's all he said. And he probably said that knowing that I was listening to his show just to make me laugh. So on the next show, on my show, at the very tag of the show, the thing we call the tag, I said to Mary, and this was merely to make Fred laugh, I said, Mary, take this. I'm going to dictate a message to Fred Allen. I want you to mail it for me. Say, dear Fred, when I was 10 years old, I could play the B too. Well, the next week, Fred had some stooges on who were supposed to have known me in Waukegan, Illinois, to prove that I couldn't play the B when I was 10 years old. The following week on my show, I brought people on from Waukegan who said I could play the B when I was 10 years old. And before we knew it, we were into the darndest feud you have ever seen, which was very funny. And the strange part of it is, I can safely say from 6 to 8 months with this feud, before we even called each other on the phone about it.
Jack, don't get excited. Look, if you're cheap, you're cheap. That's the way I look at it. Some people save asparagus ends. It's a hobby. My hobby is not spending. I hate to get these big laughs on your program.
Probably the most satisfying event to Fred in the whole wonderful feud was the night he stole Benny's britches.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. An expert operating the Hoffman pressing machine will press your trousers.
Now, wait a minute.
For 15 years, I've been waiting to catch you like
Alan,
this.
Alan, you haven't seen the end of me.
It won't be long now.
I want my pay.
What made the man so funny? We put this question to John Crosby.
A good deal of humor is just truth, just telling the truth. And Fred had that to a very great degree, a greater degree, I think, than most any man I ever saw. Many of his wittiest cracks were just something that was terribly true, but it never occurred to you until he said it.
Fred would always pick a big target.
John Royal.
Because if you're going to be provocative, and he was provocative, he made provocation, and people would take sides, and they'd bow, and he went on the basis of using words instead of the old slapstick or the bladder. He would throw custard pies with words.
The policies of the major networks in regard to censorship today is much more adult than it was in Fred's early days, so he was constantly at war with one vice president or another.
Fred was a rebel against authority.
Pat Weaver.
He objected to authority whenever it attempted to interfere with what he wanted to do. Fred actually was not a comedian who used blue material. But the censors were terribly cautious, shall we say, and would frequently read into the line something that was not there.
Practically every big-name star was at one time a guest on Fred's show, but it was an unknown guest who brought along an eagle who set the spark for one of Fred's really unforgettable broadcasts. John Crosby recalls,
the night the eagle got loose was something Fred never quite got over. The eagle
got loose and committed an indiscretion right on the audience. There were roars of laughter. Whether this really meant anything to this radio audience or not, I don't know, but they kept kidding about it for weeks and weeks later.
Well, it was a very large studio, and the eagle was bald-headed, as the American national bird is. But he became excited, and then flying from the stage to the rear balcony, his feathers flew. Needless to say, there'd been no more eagles in the studio.
The eagle has finally come to life. I think as long as the, Mr. Evans, I want to congratulate you. You were the first one to get a rise out of the eagle since he got up there. And I think as long as the eagle is a bird of prey, that we have just better discontinue the question and start praying. We have a loose eagle in the studio. Mr. Rockefeller's hurriedly building a lot of ad-lib exits here. So much time has been taken up with the Captain Knight around there with a pound of hamburger. Tried to get... Captain Knight was back there with a minute steak a little while ago, but it was too well done, and the eagle sent it back. Now, he just arrived with the proper steak, and I can assure you that Captain Knight has the eagle, or vice versa.
Show business made Fred Allen a rich man, but he remained throughout his life a man of simple taste and modest habit. Twice a day, Fred used to stop at a newsstand at the corner of 57th and 7th Avenue and visit with newsboy Stanley Truklinski.
He did so much for so many people that so few knew really about. If you looked at his face, it looked so deadpan, unsmiling at times, but yet the man had a heart so much larger than the average person.
Probably the greatest pleasure his financial independence brought him was it enabled him to help other people. Writer Mort Green recalls an amusing account of Fred's generosity.
Fred, for many years, of course, was the easiest touch on Broadway or anywhere else. If a man once played with him in a bill in Topeka, Kansas, he then suddenly considered Fred, 40 years later, to be his uncle, and wrote him a letter saying, "I need money," and Fred, of course, invariably would send it. And so there were many panhandlers around town, actual panhandlers, grifters, who would attach themselves to Fred and meet up with him wherever he went around town. Fred was a tremendous walker, a great walker. And every Sunday he used to go to Mass at St. Malachy's Church on 49th Street. And there was one fellow around town whose name was the Whistler. And he discovered that Fred was going to Mass at 11 o'clock every Sunday. And so he stationed himself along the line of march on 49th Street, a few doors up from the church, in front of a ticket office, a Broadway ticket office. And every Sunday when Fred would come by, he would say, "Hello, Fred," and Fred would say, "Hello, Whistler," and hand him $2. And this went on for a long time. As a matter of fact, it became such a routine that the Whistler got himself a little job in the ticket office running tickets for them. And one Sunday, Fred showed up, and there was no Whistler. And he looked into the ticket office, and one of the men from the ticket office came running out and said, "Fred, oh, Mr. Allen." He said, "Yes." He says, "Where's the Whistler?" And the man said, "Well, today was his birthday, so he took the day off. Would you give me $2 for him?" And Fred said, "Yes, yes, I would." And he handed him the $2 and started away. And then as an afterthought, he came back and he said, "Oh, by the way," said Fred, "would you tell the Whistler that I'm going to the coast for 8 weeks?" He says, "Here's $16, and I'll see him when I get back."
John Crosby.
He was always a target for out-of-work actors, and he used to carry, I remember, three or four different bundles of money, and he knew where the $5 bills and the $10 bills and the $1 bills were.
He was a constructive giver, too. He wasn't a soft touch. He was an understandable touch.
Uncle Jim Hawkins.
Here's what you call constructive help. Fella come up and see, says, "Jim, could I see Fred?" Well, now, he's an old-timer, you know, a fellow about 50. And, well, he says, "Tell you the truth, they're going to put the slug in the lock over at that flea bag that I'm living at over on 8th Avenue. He says, if I don't get 30 bucks, he says, I'll be carrying the banner, you know." Well, I says, "One thing before I ask him now. Did you ever play on the bill with Fred?" Oh, it's just 30-some years ago, but he wouldn't remember, Jim. I says, wait here a minute. I went in, Fred was busy writing, and I said, listen, do you ever remember an act named so-and-so-and-so-and-so? Oh, yes, Jim, yes. Gee, that was 30-some years. You know, he had the marvelous faculty of being able to reach into that pigeonhole and bringing that out. Yes, he says, sure, sure, nice act, too. Why? Well, I says, he's here now, wants to see you. He says, well, sure, be glad to see him. He said, is this clamping the dentures? You know, that's the bite. That was his expression for putting the bite on. I said, yes, it is. Oh, sure, send him in. Now the fellow comes in. He's Mr. Allen. Fred says, it wasn't Mr. 30-some years ago at the Princess in Chicago and in Rockford and Joliet, Illinois. Jesus, I didn't think you could remember. He says, why not? You did a good act. You were nice people. Now, what's your problem? He told him in the hotel. Needed $30. He says, I hate to do it, but he says, I don't know. Well, he says, we can take care of that. That's no problem, but what are you going to do? Well, he says, I'm all washed up as far as show business is concerned. I know that, eh? And I'm willing to work, but I can't get a job. Well, what kind of work? Well, he says, I'm handy around a gas station. You know, I'm not clever, but I'm handy around cars and things like that. So Fred gave him $100, a C note. Now, he set that man up in that job. He asked him if he needed any more money. He didn't. But the nicest part of the whole thing, he took that gas station telephone number, and once every week for almost a year, he would call it, and let's say for the want of a name, is this Hunt's gas station? Yeah, this is Fred Allen. Could I talk to my friend Tom Bailey? Only to give that fellow a standing among a lot of strangers.
Fred loved to eat, and he was especially fond of people who made an art of preparing and serving good food. Sue Chan recalls.
Once I remember, which I never forget, my place was burned down. So he called me at home right away. He says, Sue, I'm awfully sorry, heard that your restaurant burned down. What can we do? I said, Fred, everything's going to be all right. He said, well, you know, Porty and I, not much money, but we have a little bit put on the side. In case you need it, you can have it. So I told him, I said, Fred, I appreciate it. I may count on you, but I don't need it yet. So after reopen and during the building, every day he passing by, he never fail to walk in, to peek in and look in, see what how progress we doing. The day first we open, he return. He come to congratulate us. This kind of thought and helpful and thinking toward people, I doubted very many that we able to find today.
Biography and sound will continue transcribed after a brief pause for station identification.